No, that's the million-dollar question here, sir, in a lot of ways.
In some ways, millions of dollar question.
Yes, sir.
A Senate field hearing on lessons learned from Arctic ocean drilling. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, October 11th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the community of Homer comes to grips with a shocking assault.
There's a cloud over Homer High School right now. It is very difficult. This is a time of grief. This is a time of regrouping.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers home choice seminars that provide tools for making informed decisions about purchasing and financing a home, and loans tailored for first-time home buyers. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
The Alaska State Medical Examiner's Office has identified the deceased woman found in South Anchorage yesterday as 24-year-old Michelle Felber. Anchorage Police Department spokesman Lieutenant Dave Parker says the Anchorage resident was reported missing by her family members on Monday, October 8th, but the family had not seen Felber for at least 2 months. The body was discovered by a man walking through a wooded area near Dowling Road Wednesday. No cause or manner of death has been released by the medical examiner's office. APD homicide unit detectives are continuing their investigation. The remains of another deceased female have been found in the Mountain View neighborhood of Anchorage. Police Department spokesman Lieutenant Dave Parker says the woman's body was found by passersby around 1:30 this afternoon near the Mountain View Community Church. The body will be sent to the medical examiner's office for identification. This is the second body found outdoors this week. Police are not making a connection between the two investigations. Shell still has drill rigs working in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas, but Senator Mark Begich got an early start in Anchorage today trying to understand the lessons learned from the first season of Arctic drilling in more than two decades. At a congressional field hearing, federal agencies, local community representatives, and Shell all weighed in on what went right in the Arctic this summer and what went wrong. APRN's Annie Fite reports.
The Coast Guard had its biggest presence ever in the Arctic this summer. And after hearing Coast Guard Rear Admiral Thomas Ostebo talk about those operations, Senator Begich asked what the Coast Guard would need to do its job better in the future.
No, that's the million-dollar question here, sir, in a lot of ways.
In some ways, millions of dollar question.
Yes, sir.
It was the simple question all six people who testified were asked to address. What should be in place as offshore drilling and eventually production ramps up in the Arctic Ocean? Rear Admiral Ostebo talked about the need for H-60 helicopters and icebreakers and other ships, but he also said the region requires something much more basic, better communications.
I go back to my experience with all the way back to Exxon Valdez, 9/11, Deepwater Horizon, Hurricane Katrina. The first thing that's lost in one of those major calamities in situational awareness is the ability is bandwidth. The ability to communicate and get information out to everybody else.
That lack of basic services and infrastructure in the Arctic was a theme that came up a lot during the hearing. Laura Fergioni is acting director of the National Weather Service and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. She says demand for ice forecasting and other weather services is increasing in the Arctic, but there are limits on what the Weather Service can provide in the region.
Currently, Alaska has limited tide and current data, obsolete shoreline and hydrographic data, and in fact, most of the Arctic waters that have been charted were surveyed long ago, back to the Captain Cook days. As a result, confidence in the region's nautical charts is very low.
When it was time to hear a report from the field, Shell Alaska Vice President Pete Slaby said the company was thrilled to be working in the Arctic. But he said he was disappointed the rigs weren't able to drill into oil this summer. That's because it couldn't get its oil containment barge, the Arctic Challenger, ready in time. The Coast Guard issued its final approval to the barge Wednesday. And Slaby says the vessel's oil containment dome to stop a flowing well will be game-changing.
An ability to separate oil, gas, and water on top of a flowing well or a pipeline or other incident is something that this industry is needed since 1979.
At the hearing, Slaby made the case for revenue sharing for Alaska, and that message was echoed by the representative from the North Slope Borough. Jacob Adams is chief administrative officer for the borough.
We bear the majority of the risk of what can go wrong with OCS development and receive little direct benefit.
Adams says the borough would like a louder voice in federal decisions on offshore drilling that affect the community, but he praised Shell for the company's cautious approach during the drilling season. Environmental groups were more critical. Representatives from environmental organizations weren't invited to testify at the hearing, but Lois Epstein, Arctic Program Director for the Wilderness Society, sat in the audience. Afterwards, she said the hearing identified a lot of troubling issues.
We are going forward when we haven't fully put in place all the things that are needed, and we're moving forward regardless. And today's hearing sort of kept along that path rather than raising questions about what has gone wrong. What do we need to fix? How can we fix it before we put ourselves into a very messy situation?
Epstein says the hearing offered too much cheerleading and not enough hard questions, and she called that a missed opportunity. Shell's two drill rigs can continue work in the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas until October 31st, but may pull out earlier if conditions require it. The company won't say how many wells it's hoping to start drilling this season. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
The community of Homer is still reeling from an alleged sexual assault that occurred at a teen drinking party last month. As KBBI's Aaron Selbig reports, several organizations in Homer have attempted to spur a community dialogue around the incident.
Many of the facts are still murky around the September 8th drinking party that allegedly resulted in the sexual assault of a 17-year-old male. What is known is that two suspects, 20-year-old Anthony Resiteritz and his 18-year-old brother Joseph Resiteritz, have been charged with second-degree sexual assault for allegedly assaulting the boy with an object. The brothers were in Homer Court Tuesday, where bail was set at $5,000 for each of them. As the case continues to work its way through the legal system, the entire Homer community is asking questions. Chief among them is, why has law enforcement taken over a month to bring charges in the case? Alaska State Trooper Sergeant Jeremy Stone is the lead investigator. He says part of the reason is the sensitivity of sexual assault cases, which he says typically take longer to prosecute than others. Also, the fact that the party was attended by as many as 80 people has also complicated the investigation.
This group was so large, there's so many people to interview. There's a lack of cooperation from many witnesses for fear of getting in trouble, or the common theme has been they don't want to rat out a classmate. It's created the need for us to interview some of the same people over and over and over again. We have to find the evidence. There were indeed pictures taken, many of the individuals deleted those photos afterwards in order to avoid getting in trouble or somebody else getting in trouble from the party.
Stone says his investigation is ongoing and it is, quote, likely that others will be charged. Homer High Principal Dr. Alan G. has also come under fire for the perceived lack of response to the incident. G. says that on the Monday following the party, several student athletes came to his office and self-reported that they had attended the party. He says that when it comes to off-campus incidents like this, his power is limited to punishing student athletes who have all signed on to Alaska School Activities Association rules that prevent them from being around alcohol. G says that 14 Homer High School student athletes were temporarily suspended for violating that policy.
This was not a student school activity. It was not sanctioned by any specific sport. There are rumors that this was the football team. That is not true. But that is what we're allowed to do for student athletes. If they're not an athlete, then I have no recourse. There's no consequence because it was not a school activity.
One of the suspects in the case, Joseph Resiteritz, was a Homer High School student and a member of the football team. He has since been removed from both. G says the effect of this case on life at Homer High School has been profound.
There's a cloud over Homer High School right now. It is very difficult. This is a time of grief. This is a time of regrouping and really starting to question some of their activities.
In an editorial published Thursday in the Homer News, Homer High Student Body President and Vice President Katie Kiersis and Cruz Mori urged the community not to condemn 400 students for the actions of a few. The school has become a scapegoat for the anger of the community, they said, even though the majority of students did not participate in the incident and do not condone the behavior associated with it. Dr. G says he will push the school district to adopt a program called the Fourth R, which teaches students about healthy relationships, sexuality, and substance abuse. Jessica Lawmaster is executive director of the South Peninsula Haven House, a local organization that provides support to victims of sexual assault and domestic violence. She says for the broader community of Homer, one of the most important things is to realize that this is not an isolated incident.
We see these cases regularly at Haven House. We see adults victimized regularly. We see children victimized regularly. We serve hundreds of kids who have been sexually assaulted through our child advocacy centers across the peninsula. So what we've been trying to do in order to break the silence is talk about, first, acknowledging that our community has a problem.
Haven House has been just one of many Homer organizations that has offered public forums and meetings to help the community address the issues surrounding this incident. In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Butte residents look for answers on last month's flooding incident.
You know, people have been flooded and they've been affected and they have questions. And so they have every right to be frustrated and confused and asking those questions that they're asking.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
September saw the fewest foreclosures nationwide in 5 years. Alaska continued its downward trend as well. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, some real estate experts think the foreclosure crisis is bottoming out.
Alaska is faring better than the country and most of the states. So reports RealtyTrack in its foreclosure news report released today. Darren Bloomquist is a vice president at RealtyTrack. He says there were 146 foreclosures in Alaska in September.
We're actually pretty close to a healthy number of foreclosures, honestly, in Alaska compared to other states. If I go back even to 2005 and 2006, before we saw the foreclosure crisis hit in full force, at least nationwide, the average was 105 properties with foreclosure filings a month.
So the shorthand, Bloomquist says, is that about 100 foreclosures a month for the amount of available housing units is okay. Alaska did not experience the wild price fluctuations during the housing bubble as much as other states. There were more than 425 foreclosures in the state in the last quarter. That's a decrease of nearly 35% from the same quarter last year. Most of the foreclosures in the state were in Anchorage and the Mat-Su Valley. Bloomquist says foreclosure activity is unlikely to stop, but the rate will continue to slow.
The numbers are headed downward, but they're still not back to that normal, healthy level that we were seeing before the foreclosure crisis hit in 2007.
The report does not look at the overall health of the housing market, including interest rates, home values, and vacancies. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Golden Valley Electric Association has agreed to stricter pollution controls for the Healy Clean Coal Plant under an agreement with the Environmental Protection Agency. The utility has battled with environmental groups over proposed restart of the long-idled $300 million plant. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the agreement is the result of direct negotiation with the federal government.
A consent decree between Golden Valley Electric Association and the Environmental Protection Agency gives GVEA an air quality permit for the Healy Clean Coal Plant. In exchange, Golden Valley has agreed to install updated emissions controls and similar technology on a second utility coal plant at Healy earlier than previously scheduled. Joan Frankovich is a program manager with the Alaska Office of the National Parks Conservation Association, one of four groups who fought for stricter pollution controls. Frankovich says the groups have not been involved in negotiations since Golden Valley began working directly with the EPA earlier this year. But she says provisions of the consent decree address the key issues.
This is the same standard that is expected of any startup coal-fired power plant in the United States today. So this agreement looks good. We are pleased that of the pollution controls that they are putting on both Healy Unit 1 and Unit 2, it has been something we have been asking for years.
Frankovich says the agreement, which also includes $250,000 for wood stove changeouts in the Fairbanks and Healy areas, succeeds in protecting air quality, especially in and around Denali National Park. The Healy Clean Coal Plant was built with state and federal support in the 1990s, but Golden Valley Electric was disappointed in its performance, and years of litigation followed. GVEA and the state struck a deal for the utility to take ownership following a spike in oil prices that made coal a more appealing fuel. Permit issues have since delayed startup. Nancy Bale with the Denali Citizens Council also supports the agreement, adding the local organization never opposed the plant's restart.
But we also knew that it was closed for 10 years, and any reopening should conduct a new source review and find the best available control technology and install it. And both GVEA and the state of Alaska were willing to accept less and not conduct this new source review. Now, with the EPA involvement, which we encouraged, the utility is planning on installing the best available control technology.
Bale says it's important to remember HCCP is an existing facility right next to the Yucabeli coal mine. But Northern Alaska Environmental Center Director Dave Arnold still has concerns about another coal plant coming online.
We're disappointed with the outcome because we feel the long-term negative consequences of coal as an energy resource outweigh any short-term economic benefits. And we're a little disappointed to see that pollution controls will not be required for the first 18 months of operation, because that's when the greatest concentration of pollutants are emitted from either new or restarted coal plants. But we are pleased that there's a requirement for pollution controls that would have not been in place had we not brought this to the public's attention.
The EPA will hold a 30-day public comment period on the agreement. A judge will then consider its approval. The Regulatory Commission of Alaska also has to okay it. GVEA spokeswoman Diane Porter says the utility opted for the binding consent decree process with the EPA to avoid costly litigation with environmental groups, but the agreement still leaves financial hurdles.
The total cost is going to be about $110 million, and breaking that down, there was a sale price agreed upon of $50 million for the plant. It will take approximately $20 million to get it ready for startup. The additional controls on HCCP that we agreed to in the consent decree will come in at around $40 million, and the additional nitrous oxide controls to Healy 1 will be probably less than $5 million.
The price will add to Golden Valley's existing $381 million in debt, but Porter says money saved by swapping oil-fired power for cheaper coal-generated electricity pencils out. There's no precise estimate on how much HCCP will lower power rates. Porter says low-cost financing, including a $45 million line of credit with the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, will be tapped to cover startup costs. The plan is expected to come online in 18 to 24 months. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com.
State Homeland Security officials estimate the cost of recent flooding in Alaska has topped $13 million. That includes damage to state and borough infrastructure from Seward to Nenana, but does not include ruined individually owned property. In the Matanuska-Susitna borough, many residents are still coming to grips with how much the flood will cost them. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports.
High water continues to plague the Matanuska-Susitna borough as at least two local creeks crested over the past weekend. Only two roads remain closed in the borough at this time, out of the 100 roads either disrupted or closed during what is now being termed the flood of 2012.
And every insurance company has the ability to write a flood policy.
Mat-Su borough officials and state homeland security personnel faced flood victims recently in the area near Palmer, locally known as the Butte. The meeting was planned as an informational session to guide those affected by the flood through necessary paperwork to receive assistance. But frustrations among some owners of flood-damaged property surfaced quickly.
Can we do it? We've got some dump trucks. We can fill that sucker up tomorrow.
Butte homeowners criticized borough officials for not moving fast enough to warn people of impending floodwaters. Casey Cook, the borough's deputy emergency services director, told the crowd that documentation will help in the borough and state's damage assessment and will speed up getting affected residents money to rebuild. But people complained about the $100 price of a borough floodplain development permit.
You know, people have been flooded and they've been affected and they have questions. And so they have every right to be frustrated and confused and asking those questions that they're asking. And we expect that. I think the biggest concern for this area, the Butte area, is any future mitigation to maybe stop this or slow this from happening again. And so I think that's the biggest one right now that I've seen is how do we stop this from happening again?
The high water seemed to have a mind of its own. In one location on the old Glen Highway, a house and a nearby trailer are tottering over the eroded edge of the Matanuska River. Those structures are a total loss. The owner did not want to talk to the media about it. But just a mile or so down the road, water avoided a house where Robert Armour and his wife Jo live with friendly dogs, cats, and horses.
Oh, the horses were in better shape than most of the people were. He built that especially elevated. He brought in more gravel and built it up so the horses are higher than most of the house.
The rambling old-style ranch home is about a stone's throw from the Knick River. It was built by a man who owned a sawmill.
So anyway, he built the house and did it in 53, and it's been here ever since, and they've never had water in the house.
The Armours live on a sliver of land between the highway and the river. A creek runs into the river just east of their property, slicing in between the Armours and a nearby neighbor's property. The neighbors evacuated, but Armour and his wife never budged.
No, the water just came up a little bit over the edge of the bank. From the bank, we're probably 5 feet above the bank. Well, the house was built that way. They put the raised the ground up enough that they didn't have to worry about it.
Other area homeowners were not so fortunate. They experienced firemen knocking on their doors at midnight, warning them to evacuate. Armour has suggested to the borough that dredging the river could be one way to mitigate floods.
They used to dig gravel out of the Matanuska, and then the Army Corps of Engineers shut them off. And they need to get out there where that island is out there and start digging a channel up through there and do it in the summertime when there's no water and dig it out about 200 feet, 10 feet deep. And they wouldn't have lost these houses.
The borough's Casey Cook says that river dredging was done years ago, and the borough is considering it.
It's at the state level now to figure out if that's going to be a possible avenue to go down and find out about.
But dredging could hurt salmon fry, and some officials are wary of that solution. Armour says the borough did a good job in responding to the flood disaster. He says he has flood insurance, as required for property in a floodplain, but that rates for the federally managed insurance plan are very high. He says it may be a better idea for individual states to manage flood insurance. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
State and federal officials are investigating the skull found near Wrangell last weekend during a fishing trip. KSTK's Ariel Van Cleve explains.
Vina Stowe and her family were fishing off Government Slough when she found a partial skull. She turned the remains over to local police, who notified the U.S. Forest Service in Wrangell. Tongass archaeologist Mark McCallum says he sent pictures of the skull to the state medical examiner.
The state medical examiner's office has forensic anthropologists on staff who will be able to make an initial assessment as to the potential for Native American ancestry Based on that initial assessment, they'll determine the need, if there is one, to transport those remains up to Anchorage for further examination.
He says if the medical examiner's office determines the remains belong to an Alaska Native, the case will be in the Forest Service's hands and the agency will follow the rules laid out through the Native American Graves Protection Act. McCollum says federal law requires them to create a plan of action regarding transfer of custody and burial of the remains in consultation with the local tribes. He says the Forest Service has already been in contact with the Wrangell Cooperative Association, and the agency's in the process of getting in touch with the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes and officials with the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute. WCA President Ernie Christian says if it's confirmed that the remains are Native, the board and elders will determine what to do next.
You know, until we actually see the remains and determine if they're Native origins, then we'll move forward in the correct manner. But since it's very new, and I think it's always when we find my own perspective, it's great to know, get the historical background and you know, show that the Natives have been in Alaska for many thousands of years, and so that's always exciting.
He says he would like to find out more about the remains if they're of Native origin.
We have other remains that we're in the process of taking care of, and in the back channel there was some hand bones that were found and carbon dated, and they were, if I remember right, over 3,500 years old. So if we do the same with this remains that were currently found to date it, we might possibly do that just to give us an idea.
McCallum says he commends the people who made the discovery because they took pictures of its location, pinpointed the spot through Google Maps, and turned the skull over to local police. He says it's better not to disturb the remains, but in this instance, taking the skull with them was the best option.
I've learned today that the location that the skull was found has since flooded, that slough, which was dry last week, is now inundated. So I believe that they made the right call.
McCallum says discoveries like this one are not uncommon in Southeast and expects an initial determination in a few days. He says if it's discovered the remains are not of Native origin, the Alaska State Troopers and local police would become involved. In Wrangell, I'm Ariel Van Cleve.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dacia Eaton in Anchorage, Aaron Selbig in Homer, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ellen Lockyer in Butte, and Ariel Van Cleve in Wrangell. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by Condor Airlines, offering nonstop service to Frankfurt from Anchorage and Fairbanks between May and September, with connections to most German and European destinations. Details available at condor.com. Alaska Pacific University offers convenient, high-quality, affordable adult undergraduate programs. Applications are due October 19th. Apply at alaskapacific.edu or by calling 564-8248. This message sponsored by APU.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.